a new book explores the Challenger disaster. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. On January 28, 1986, seven astronauts lost their lives when the space shuttle Challenger broke apart 73 seconds after launch. It was a tragic day for the nation and the space shuttle program. Among the crew were career NASA astronauts, along with a teacher who planned to conduct lessons for her students while in orbit. She was the first private citizen to be chosen to fly into space. In his new book, author and journalist Adam Higginbotham explores the events that led up to the explosion and the impact that the disaster had on the future of space exploration. Challenger, a true story of heroism and disaster on the edge of space. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? The Space Shuttle Challenger disaster gripped the nation. At 11:39 a.m., just 73 seconds after launch, the space shuttle broke apart over the Atlantic. All seven astronauts were killed. It was a moment that stunned the nation, the first time a U.S. spacecraft experienced the loss of crew in flight. President Ronald Reagan addressed the nation from the Oval Office that evening.
Today is a day for mourning and remembering. Nancy and I are pained to the core by the tragedy of the shuttle Challenger. We know we share this pain with all of the people of our country. This is truly a national loss. 19 years ago, almost to the day, we lost three astronauts in a terrible accident on the ground. But we've never lost an astronaut in flight. We've never had a tragedy like this. And perhaps we've forgotten the courage it took for the crew of the shuttle. But they, the Challenger 7, were aware of the dangers, but overcame them and did their jobs brilliantly. We mourn seven heroes: Michael Smith, Dick Scobee, Judith Resnick, Ronald McNair, Ellison Onizuka, Gregory Jarvis, and Krista Mikhailov. We mourn their loss as a nation together.
An investigation found O-rings on the solid rocket boosters were to blame, despite engineers raising the alarm ahead of that cold morning launch. In his new book, Challenger, a true story of heroism and disaster on the edge of space, author and journalist Adam Higginbotham looks at the investigation into the accident and the lives of those involved. He joins us now to talk about his book. Adam, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Adam, the Challenger explosion happened some 38 years ago, January 28th, 1986. Your book is a chronicling of what led up to that, the actual accident itself, and how the nation and NASA dealt with it. But the first question I want to ask you is, how did you come across this particular story, especially one that is almost four decades old?
It was brought to mind initially because when I was promoting the previous book that I wrote, called Midnight in Chernobyl, which was about the Chernobyl accident, I was often asked whether I remembered where I was when I heard the news. But I did remember exactly where I was when I heard the news about the Challenger accident. And I remember getting home from school that day because I was a schoolboy in England at the time, and there was a time difference. So in England, it was about 4:38 in the afternoon when the accident happened. And I didn't learn about it until I got home that night when my mother told me that she heard about it on the TV news. But I remember very clearly how incomprehensible I found it, and how I struggled to believe that such a thing was possible. Because up until that point, you know, NASA had got an apparently seamless record of achieving the almost impossible on a regular basis. So it was at the front of my mind when I sat down to start thinking about ideas for writing a second book. And there were also ways in which it kind of, you know, because it happened almost exactly 3 months before the Chernobyl accident, there are ways in which it presented itself as a kind of other side of the mirror of the Chernobyl story. They had a lot of things in common. They happened at around the same time. You know, what was going on in the Soviet Union and what was going on in America at the same time seemed as if they were happening in parallel.
The accidents and the way that they happened and the path to the accidents had a lot in common. You know, they were both the results of budget cutting, of attempting to meet increasingly unreasonable deadlines. They were also the result of failures of safety culture and of technicians effectively constantly pushing their luck and encountering small failures, which they ignored and thought that every time they pushed their luck and there wasn't an accident, then they could keep going and proceed as they had been before.
Adam, as we mentioned at the start of this conversation, the Challenger accident was in 1986. But the book, Challenger, A True Story of Heroism and Disaster on the Edge of Space, doesn't start there. It starts in 1967. Tell us about why you chose to set this book at Pad 34 during the Apollo 1 fire.
Well, it's really because what I realized when I began looking into the history of the Challenger accident was that there are ways in which NASA effectively experienced the same accident over and over again. And I discovered that there was many parallels between the Apollo 1 fire, which, as you say, took place in 1967, that set the stage for what happened in 1986. And similarly, there were parallels between what happened in 1986 and in 2003 when Columbia was lost on re-entry.
It's a story that's bookended by those two accidents, one in 1967 and one in 2003. And Challenger takes place within that broad context. And there are ways in which, you know, what happened with Apollo 1 clearly foreshadows what happened with Challenger. And yet those lessons were, to the extent that they were learned.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with author and journalist Adam Higginbotham about his new book, Challenger, A True Story of Heroism and Disaster on the Edge of Space. Let's go to 1986. Let's talk about that point in time. What was it like at NASA and the space shuttle program leading up to this mission that may have or that did contribute to what happened on that day?
Well, the story of the space shuttle program between the first launch of the first mission in 1981 and Challenger is similar to the story that NASA had experienced with its previous programs, especially the Apollo program, which is that initially the public was wowed and excited by the audacious and heroic exploits of the astronauts on the route to the moon. And obviously, you know, the moon landing was watched by record television audiences around the world. But by 1972, when the astronauts of Apollo 17 were walking on the moon, the public had become bored even by the amazing spectacle of men walking on the lunar surface, to the extent that American television networks at the time received telephone calls of complaint from viewers who were objecting to the fact that the latest episode of the hot new soap opera, Medical Center, had been postponed in favor of footage of men walking on the moon, which in retrospect seems astonishing. But the same thing, exactly the same thing happened with the shuttle program. The public was extremely engaged and excited by the shuttle program with that first launch in 1981, to the extent that 250,000 people turned out to watch it land in California at the end of the mission. But one of the announced intentions of the program was to make space flight routine, to make the shuttle fly as frequently and as safely into space as an airliner. They originally envisaged that it would be taking off sometimes as frequently as once a week and returning to the Cape at the end of a mission. And by the time of the Challenger launch, they had succeeded in this goal to the extent that shuttle launches began to seem quotidian enough that people weren't that interested anymore. And indeed, the three national television networks had stopped covering launches live because they just seemed to be happening so frequently. And for this, NASA represented a serious public relations problem, because they had long believed that in order to guarantee themselves continued funding from Congress, they needed an engaged and excited public. So the idea that the public might be losing interest in what they were up to with manned spaceflight was extremely unwelcome. And as a result of that fear of losing public engagement, they kept expanding what they were doing, taking on more and more ambitious projects. And eventually they came up with the Space Flight Participant Program, which was one of their gambits to get the public more interested in what they were doing. And that was a program to fly ordinary citizens in space.
And the first category of spaceflight participant they selected was a school teacher. And winning out from a field of more than 11,000 candidates was Kristen McAuliffe, who was a high school social studies teacher who taught in Concord, New Hampshire. And again, that was very successful, and that brought a huge amount of attention to the shuttle program and to the Challenger launch, which was originally scheduled for the beginning of January 1986. But it experienced a series of delays that followed on from a record number of launch delays with the previous flight of Columbia at the beginning of the month. And this was a series of humiliating setbacks for NASA, as you know, one launch delay followed another. And it just looked bad on the news. It was a public relations disaster that they couldn't seem to get these extremely sophisticated spacecraft off the ground. So between the attention drawn by Kristen McAuliffe and the teacher in space idea and the series of delays that had already taken place, these two things created an enormous amount of pressure to get the shuttle off the ground as quickly as possible and not to suffer any further launch delays, partly from a PR standpoint, but also partly because they had scheduled that 1986 would be the busiest year in NASA history. They'd scheduled 15 launches in total for the year, so more than one a month, which was unprecedented. They'd never done that before. So in order to keep looking good, to keep the public engaged, to keep the media happy, and to keep their roster of space flights on track, they really needed to get off on time.
I mean, with that said, there is that pressure there. But also that day, January 28th, 1986, was not the best day to launch. I mean, take us back to that. And even as you chronicle, even the astronauts weren't thinking that they were going to launch, right? I mean, what led up to the tragedy of 73 seconds after that countdown clock hit zero?
Well, the reason that it didn't seem like they were going to launch, and the reason that many of the astronauts on the Challenger crew went out to the launch pad that morning thinking that they were going to be facing another scrub, that the launch would be postponed until later in the week, was because the weather was extremely cold. It was one of the coldest days in Florida history. And one of the specific reasons that this seemed poor weather in which to launch was that almost exactly a year before, in January 1985, the shuttle Discovery had launched in what was, up until that point, the coldest weather in Florida history. And when the technicians from Morton Thiokol recovered the solid rocket boosters that had carried the shuttle into launch that had carried the shuttle into orbit that day, they discovered that there was erosion in the O-rings that sealed the joints in the rocket together, worse than they had ever seen before. And they believed that this was probably a result of the O-rings becoming stiff and inflexible in the cold. And so following that, they pressed for there to be a redesign of the joints in the solid rockets, because they feared that if the O-rings didn't seal the joints properly, there could be a leak of hot gas from inside the rockets during the launch phase, during the ascent phase, and that could lead to a catastrophic explosion and the destruction of the orbiter. But they didn't press to have flight stop completely, because they reasoned that what they'd experienced in January of 1985 was a 100-year weather event. So they had time to fix these joints and redesign the joints and the O-rings before any such weather event would ever be so cold again as to cause problems of a similar scale. So the Thiokol engineers, when they heard on January the 27th, 1986, that they were facing another 100-year weather event just 12 months later, they were absolutely aghast. And at that point, began pulling together their data to try to show NASA that it would be extremely unwise to launch. And they eventually produced a no-go recommendation for launch, which is the first time in Morton Thiokol's time with NASA that they had recommended against a launch in this way.
Still to come, our conversation with author Adam Higginbotham on his book, Challenger, A True Story of Heroism and Disaster on the Edge of Space. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. We've been speaking with Adam Higginbotham about his new book, Challenger, a true story of heroism and disaster on the edge of space. Before this break, we talked about Adam's inspiration for this nonfiction book and his connection to the disaster. In the days that led up to the explosion, Florida was exposed to cold weather with ice collecting on the launch pad, but there may have been more than one reason for the disaster. Our conversation with Higginbotham continues. Obviously, mission managers did not take that into account, and they did launch. What did we find out after the accident about those decisions? Is there one person or one group that is to blame for what happened to this crew in 1986?
I don't think that there is one group. I think that it's one of those situations where there was a whole chain of decisions and events that led up to it. It's very easy in retrospect to lay blame at the door of the handful of NASA middle managers at the Marshall Space Flight Center who were running this meeting the night before the launch, and put an enormous amount of pressure on the Thiokol engineers and the Thiokol executives to change their recommendation. But during the course of that meeting, and you know, in the 12 hours between the end of the meeting and the actual launch, you know, there were numerous opportunities off ramps for people to change their minds, for people to make recommendations that would have stopped the launch. And it just so happened that for a variety of different reasons, not least of which was this launch pressure, they all decided to go ahead with the launch as planned.
And because of that, we did lose 7 astronauts. You mentioned Krista McAuliffe at the start of our conversation, very high profile astronaut on this mission. But there were 6 others, and the book tells the story of all of the crew. Adam, is there a particular person that you found incredibly intriguing as you were researching this book who was on board that day?
Yeah, I mean, all of the other 6 members of the crew and McAuliffe have these fascinating stories. The one member of the crew I was sort of astonished to discover did not have a biopic dedicated entirely to their life was Ron McNair, who grew up in Lake City, South Carolina, and as a boy, the middle child of 3 brothers, picked cotton in the fields near his house to make extra money, but then went on to graduate with a doctorate in laser physics from MIT, became the 2nd African-American in space. He was a black belt in karate. He was an accomplished jazz saxophonist. Indeed, he had cooked up a plan with the French electronic musician Jean-Michel Jarre in the year before the Challenger launch to record a song that Jarre had written for him and play it on the saxophone in space as part of a concert that Jarre was going to be playing in Houston at around the time of the Challenger mission. And this was only canceled at the very last minute when Dick Scobee, the commander, wouldn't let him take his instrument on the mission. But McNair's story is just kind of remarkable. He was a fascinating character.
Followers of human spaceflight in this day will know that there are some safety features built into spacecraft, both NASA's commercial partners, SpaceX and Boeing. They have in-flight abort capabilities. Even the Russian Soyuz capsule, if I recall most recently in 2018, a crewed mission aborted mid-flight. Why wasn't that the case for Challenger? Was there no way that they could have escaped this fate?
Yeah, the space shuttle was originally part of a much larger and more complex system for spaceflight, which would have included bases on the moon and nuclear powered rockets designed for missions to Mars. And eventually NASA was told that almost all aspects of this system were just too expensive to pay for in the early 70s when rampant inflation and the costs of the war in Vietnam and the Great Society program began to eat into government funding for everything. And so they eventually just settled on designing this reusable spacecraft that would go up and down into low Earth orbit.
But even then, when they went to the Nixon White House with their budget estimates, they said that NASA said that they would need around $14 billion to get this thing into space. And the Office of Management and Budget looked at this for a while and then came back to them and said, well, you can't have $14 billion. You can have five and a half, which obviously is less than half of what they asked for. So that made things almost impossible from the outset, but it meant that in the course of the design and construction of the shuttle, they had to make all sorts of expedient compromises. And one of those was that it would be the first manned spacecraft in NASA's history that would not feature an escape system that could be used by the astronauts in the case of an emergency during the ascent phase to orbit.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with author and journalist Adam Higginbotham about his new book, Challenger, A True Story of Heroism and Disaster on the Edge of Space. Adam, we've had the opportunity to speak with multiple astronauts on this show here, and we talk about risk. And to me, it's always a bit of a surprise or shock when you hear them talk about risk and know that, you know, they know that this is risky, and they know what has happened to Apollo 1 and Challenger and Columbia, and yet they still decided to take on this career in the pursuit of exploration. From what you gathered about this crew of seven on Challenger, were they aware of the risks of what it was like to fly on shuttle, as you mentioned in the book, one of the most complicated machines, if not the most complicated machines in human history? Did they know what they were getting into?
Yeah, absolutely they did. And that's one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book in the first place, was because I felt that a lot of the way that the story has been told in the past has rested on the idea that the crew of Challenger, not just Kristen McAuliffe, but all the other six members of the crew, went in some ways ignorantly to their deaths, that they were the victim of a risky spacecraft that they really didn't understand the complexities of. But the truth is that all of them, including McAuliffe, understood all too well that, you know, flying an experimental spacecraft into orbit was fraught with danger. Four of the astronauts on board had already flown into space once each. And they knew that this was a complex machine. They knew exactly what the risks were, although they didn't know the specific risks of the O-rings, because those things, while discussed amongst the engineering staff at Thiokol and at the Marshall Space Flight Center, the significance of those problems had not been escalated to a point where many people in the astronaut office knew about them. But I think that, you know, this idea that they were ignorant of the risks really does the members of the Challenger crew a great disservice, because it underestimates the conscious heroism that it took to climb aboard the shuttle and go on these missions.
Finally, Adam, as we are taping this conversation, it marks 4 years since Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley flew to space on SpaceX's Crew Dragon capsule in what is a new chapter of human space exploration here in the U.S. and for NASA. That's since 4 years ago now, so I struggle to say we are still in that first chapter. But with human space missions happening frequently and often, almost every 6 months now, as someone who is so intimate with the story of Challenger, are there concerns that history may repeat itself once again, as spaceflight becomes routine?
Well, I don't know. I think that spaceflight might be becoming more frequent, but I don't think that anyone is any longer under the illusion that it will become routine. It's worth bearing in mind that the contractors, SpaceX and Boeing, both have it written into their contracts that their risk of catastrophic failure cannot be any worse than one in, I believe, 270 at this point. And the risk of catastrophic failure in the solid rockets, as they were assessed in the mid-70s by a contractor hired by NASA for that purpose, was around 1 in 27. So you can see in those, you know, now more than 40 years since that assessment was made, that's an improvement, a tenfold improvement in the expectations of safety. So things are definitely going in the right direction, but, you know, one in 270, those are definitely not odds that I would take. But I don't think that anyone is any longer under the illusion that this is not an experimental and an extremely hazardous practice.
And truly, final question, Adam, now that this book is written and out, are you thinking of the next one? And is there more in the space program that you want to explore? Essentially, can I scoop your next book? What are you writing?
The honest answer is that I don't know what the next book is going to be. I'm open to suggestions, Brent. But no, I'm still so deeply in this subject that I've not started thinking about the next one.
It's a brilliant book, brilliantly written. Even though I know the outcome of it, I still thought that things might change with how you presented the stories of the people involved in the Challenger program. Adam Higginbotham is the author of Challenger, A True Story of Heroism and Disaster on the Edge of Space. Adam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Brendan.
That's going to do it for this week's show. Next week, we take a look at NASA's Dragonfly mission and what scientists hope to uncover with this drone as it explores Titan, the moon of Saturn. Stay listening. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to this show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. You can do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're AWTY Space. Are we there yet? AWTY, get it? And if you got an idea for a future episode of this show or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. We're at arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. And we got more space coverage online. Visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet? It's a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Sophie Diaz. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.